more pleased to see her. Doug and I were heading to Cole's graduation at Colorado College. We are, as I've noted, a big, beautiful, blended family. And the group traveling to Colorado Springs that weekend kept getting bigger. Crammed in an Uber to the small hotel where we'd all be staying, my mother-in-law began to hold forth on her opinions of Donald Trump. Unsurprisingly, they were not positive. I could feel the animus emanating from the driver, and I began to worry that we might not make it to our destination. I love my family, but there's a lot of it, and sometimes it's a lot. At one point, I crept off with Doug to have a quiet drink in the hotel's tiny bar. Sitting there, I silently prayed for patience and a bit of relief from the brood. And then the answer. Through the door walked Oprah Winfrey. She was there without fanfare because one of the students from her school for impoverished girls in South Africa was also graduating, and she'd come to cheer her. That's who she is, and just one of the many things about her that I admire. She gave me a big hug and pulled up a seat so we could catch up. Bill Clinton, speaking for the 12th time at a Democratic convention, delivered firm words. Like the cop who arrives at the door of a rowdy party, he wanted the music turned down a little. We were getting euphoric too soon, he warned. We've seen more than one election slip away from us when we thought it couldn't happen, he said, clearly referring to Hillary's 2016 loss to Trump. Don't get distracted by phony issues, he admonished. Never underestimate your adversary. Bill Clinton knows how to weave a tale. He's one of the best storytellers in modern politics. And why was I surprised that this night, instead of his allotted 12 minutes, he would speak for 29? He wasn't the only speaker who went long. Once again, the keynote speaker, Tim Walz, was pushed partially out of primetime in the East. Which was too bad, because Tim gave a great speech, introducing himself to the country, making the case for me, attacking Trump on abortion and on Project 2025, presenting the values of our campaign by calling on specific examples from his own life. He told of his and Gwen's struggle with infertility, of how it had taken years of treatments before hope was born. When he spoke directly to his family, "You are my whole world," hope in the audience made heart hands, and a tearful Gus stood up and passionately cried, "That's my dad." At that moment, even the hardened reporters in the press box were reaching for a tissue. August 22nd, 75 days to the election. The convention, day 4. I did 27 drafts of my convention speech. I knew what was riding on it. It was my best chance to grab the attention of voters who did not know me. It would be my opportunity to introduce or reintroduce myself to the American people. I needed to tell them who I was, what had shaped me, why I was running. I needed to prosecute the case against Trump and then explain my own vision for the country. All in 40 minutes. As we worked on the final draft, Adam Frankel came down with COVID. He retreated to quarantine in his hotel room. We'd been working closely together and he was terrified he had infected me. Fortunately, he had not. On the phone, we continued the work of refining line by line, word by word. While I sat in the green room, waiting to go on stage, I saw that Opal, my body person, had thoughtfully placed photographs. My mother at a protest, me and my grandfather, the people I loved, who were missing from the room that night. So many people who formed me had died. I believe you can tell a lot about who a person is when you know who their people are. But many of my people aren't here. My mother, my grandfather, my second mother, Mrs. Shelton, my Aunt Mary, my Uncle Sherman, my Uncle Freddie. I was grateful for the ones who were. Cousin Sharda, Uncle Balu, my Chitti, Chinni. Chinni is my mother's youngest sister. In Tamil, there's no exact equivalent word for aunt. The word Chitti translates as younger mother. I actually have two younger mothers. My Chitti, Sarla, couldn't make the trip from India. The movie director, Greta Gerwig, had helped me rehearse. Her combination of gentleness and strength, modesty and smarts, made it clear how she'd managed to elicit so many great performances. When you speak about your family, she advised, see their faces. A professional voice coach had also offered to come limber up my vocal presentation. She was very serious about her job. But she wanted me to stand there and emit animal noises. For cover, I enlisted my entire team to join me. We could all be embarrassed together as we made the weird hums, grunts, and trills she instructed us to produce. We'd practiced in a room set up within the hotel to mimic the layout of the stage. In rehearsal, I walked out into the makeshift circle of stars that marked the speaker's place, waving foolishly at nobody. When I walked out for real, the crowd was on their feet, roaring. It took many minutes to quiet them. I wanted to share the nuances of my background, including my mother's extraordinary journey, her act of love and self-determination in marrying my father, a fellow student studying economics from Jamaica, instead of returning to India as expected to an arranged marriage. Although they separated when I was 5, I am grateful to my father for many things, including instilling a sense of fearlessness in me. When we'd go to the park, my mother would say, stay close. But he would say, run, Kamala, run. Don't be afraid. Don't let anything stop you. I wanted people to see that in ways that matter, my story was also their story. To see themselves in our neighborhood of nurses and firefighters, in my sister and me on our banana seat bikes, in my mother's struggle to save the down payment to finally own our own home. I wanted people to know that I, like them, cherish both my family by blood and my family by love. I recounted how I'd chosen to be a prosecutor after my best friend in high school confided that she was being molested by her stepfather. I said that when I had a case, I charged it not in the name of the victim, but in the name of the people. Because a harm against any one of us is a harm against all of us, and no one who is a victim should stand alone. I told how every day in the courtroom, I stood proudly before a judge and I said 5 words, Kamala Harris for the people. In my career, I said, I've only had 1 client, the people. And so, on behalf of the people, on behalf of every American, regardless of party, race, gender, or the language your grandmother speaks, on behalf of my mother and everyone who has ever set out on their own unlikely journey, on behalf of Americans like the people I grew up with, people who work hard, chase their dreams, and look out for one another, on behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination to be President of the United States of America. There had been speculation that Chicago might erupt in violence as it did in 1968 during the Vietnam War. That hadn't happened. Mignon's team had worked closely with Chicago police, everyone on the same page regarding the importance of respecting free speech and practicing de-escalation if things got heated. The Gaza protests outside the convention remained mostly peaceful. Inside also, Mignon had made sure that every delegation had a veteran whip, someone with long experience of conventions, taking the temperature of their delegates and working for solidarity. But there was tension and some bitterness, that we had not given a speaking slot to a Palestinian spokesperson. I knew that the section of my speech dealing with the Gaza war had a lot riding on it. As David von Drilly wrote in the Washington Post, it was, quote, the rockiest, most perilous passage. Her 5.0 degree of difficulty straddle on the war in Gaza. She charged right in and defended Israel, and just as it felt as though the room might split, she affirmed the humanity and suffering of the Palestinians. She then moved into a peroration on the subject that everyone was able to cheer for. And behold, she had her boat through the impossible strait. Jon Favreau, who had been director of speech writing in the Obama White House, remarked on his show, Pod Save America, "She looked and sounded more presidential in this convention speech than almost any other candidate I've ever seen accept the nomination. Her presentation, her delivery, her confidence, it was a sight to behold." August 28th, 69 days to the election. In Savannah, Georgia, Tim Walz and I hopped on our campaign bus for a two-day barnstorming tour of Southeast Georgia. It's an area that doesn't get a lot of love from Democratic candidates. But we were after every vote in a state that was polling as evenly split and in which every vote mattered. The big bus had been custom painted blue with a red stripe and stars and the message, "A New Way Forward." Before we boarded, we spoke with a group of students from Savannah State University, Georgia's oldest HBCU. Joining us on the bus was the mayor of the city, Van R. Johnson, a former police officer who shares my passion for small business and creating opportunity for people to build wealth. We headed out of the city through woods draped with Spanish moss and lush wetlands to Liberty County High School in Hinesville, where the school's marching band played for us. I told the band members that I, too, had been in my school band. I played everything from the French horn to the kettle drum. With the horn players, I shared that I'd given up the horn because it involved entirely too much spit. Tim and some of my team members later said that they were surprised to learn about my one-time musical prowess. It was another example of how there were so many more ways to connect with people if only I'd had more time. On the way back to town, we stopped at Sandfly Barbecue, where we chatted with the owners and a group of teachers who happened to be dining there. At 7:40 p.m., we reached the Savannah Hotel, where we would stay the night. In my 4 years as vice president, I can count on one hand the times I've walked through the front door of a hotel. I don't see the flower-bedecked foyers, the marble staircases. For security reasons, we go through loading docks, kitchens, the long, unadorned passageways walked by housekeepers and janitors. We take the service elevators, just like the people whose work allows for the comfortable stays of business travelers and tourists. We move through the spaces reserved for workers who are rarely seen, barely noticed. I always made sure that the campaign booked us in hotels where the staff are union members, and very often, those unfancy passageways and utility rooms were decked with posters praising the employees of the month or messages about leadership or safety or boosting morale. I would stop and read these messages. It allowed me to connect for a few moments with the people who did the work that would afford me a good night's sleep, a good breakfast. Whenever I could, I shook their hands and let them know they were appreciated. August 29th, 68 days to the election. First interview. I left the campaign bus and stepped through a warm Savannah rain into the restaurant where my first major interview with CNN's Dana Bash was to take place. Kim's Cafe is a family-owned soul food restaurant that supports causes such as literacy and young entrepreneurs. famed for its generous portions of chitlins and smothered shrimp, it would have been perfect for a drop-in visit with the owners and their community. It was not a good choice as background for a sit-down television interview. As soon as I saw the setup, I felt uneasy. Emptied of customers, with blinds mostly drawn, it felt claustrophobic. Behind us in the shot was a distracting background, a table set with mugs and dishes. Tim Walls and I were seated opposite Dana Bash at a small table probably designed for dinner for two. Our faces were so close, I felt like we should deploy breath mints. I'd done enough TV interviews to be aware of how the lighting is supposed to work, the three-point setup of key light, fill light, and backlight that usually produces a flattering, even tone. But whatever this setup was, the lights cast dark shadows under my eyes and made me look worn out. The way the seats were arranged relative to the camera emphasized the difference in stature between Tim and me. I have a short body and long legs. Tim's a big man, with a footballer's massive torso. Seated next to him at that angle, I had to keep glancing up at him. Not a good look. We'd wanted to do the interview on the campaign bus, but the Secret Service said no. There were too many security features on that bus that might be revealed in a camera shot. After Trump's close call, the agents were even more than usually cautious. As a candidate moving fast through the blur of the campaign, you can't micromanage every detail. Your team must feel that you trust them. If you're constantly second-guessing them, it's bad for morale. These kinds of details, the set, the lighting, the chairs, the angle, were the kinds of things my advance person should have noticed. But in the scramble to find an alternative venue in the agreed window of time when both Dana Bash and I would be in town, it hadn't happened. This was my long-awaited first interview. In truth, it was far from the first. I had done dozens of interviews before I became top of the ticket. Mainstream outlets such as 60 Minutes, People Magazine, NPR's Latino USA, also numerous podcasts with large audiences, like The Shade Room, Pop Sugar, Baby, This is Kiki Palmer, and Dear Asian Americans. There had been a lot of chatter about the timing of this first interview. After becoming the candidate, that I should have done it sooner and followed quickly with several more. There was a feeling that we needed to feed the beast. But I knew that beast would eviscerate me if I wasn't properly prepared. And I had to cram that prep time into all the other things that needed to be done in the 39 days I'd had, crafting a comprehensive policy agenda distinct from Biden's, designing a convention, giving a convention speech, getting to swing states, vetting and picking a VP, being the vice president. I wanted to do the interview as soon as possible, but I couldn't get away with doing it badly. I'm not interested in doing jujitsu with reporters, ducking questions or obfuscating. I want to be thoughtful and responsive in my answers, no matter what is asked. I needed to be sure I was ready. As a former prosecutor, I know the importance of being prepared. Early in my courtroom career, when I was still a law clerk, I'd been prosecuting a case that required showing the jury elaborate maps. Explaining one of the maps, I'd become confused about north and south and had to keep correcting myself in front of the jury. After the trial, which I won, the judge had called me to his chambers and read me the riot act. "Don't you ever do that again," he chided. "You've got to know every detail of your case." Later, as Attorney General, going after irresponsible banks or a corrupt for-profit college, I was aware that what I said could move markets. I have been conditioned by my career to weigh my every word. I wanted the interview to be flawless. I needed my A game. I didn't bring it. And that's on me. Bash's first question: if you are elected, what would you do on day one in the White House? It's a cliche question, and I should have expected it. and had a pat answer in my pocket about the executive orders I intended to sign. The truth, day one is performative. That's not when the big problems are going to get solved. So instead of a tidy, headline-making soundbite, I reeled off a slew of priorities such as extending the child tax credit, the most clearly proven way to quickly lift families out of poverty, the tax credit I wanted for first-time home buyers, my determination to end price gouging. I was setting out my agenda, and on day one, I would absolutely begin working on these things. Unlike Trump, I didn't have a mouthful of lies about ending wars and lowering grocery prices on day one. I knew those kinds of things weren't possible, and I wasn't going to take the audience for fools. I did slightly better on the follow-up. Bash asked me why I hadn't already accomplished the items on my agenda during my time in office. This gave me a chance to remind viewers of the chaos we'd inherited from Trump, the mismanaged COVID crisis, an economy in freefall. Our priority, I said, had been saving lives and saving jobs, and we'd brought the U.S. economy back faster than any other wealthy nation. But I didn't stop there. Joe was justifiably proud of that recovery and felt the statistics, inflation down below 3% from a high of over 9%, wage increases outpacing inflation, millions of new jobs created, should be enough to convince people that he was a good manager of the economy. But I knew people didn't yet feel these metrics in their daily life. It wasn't what they experienced when they went to buy food or gas. I addressed that pain, acknowledging that prices were still too high. I said that's why now, with the COVID crisis behind us, the time was right to enact all the cost of living measures I proposed. It was a good answer, but there was a better one. I should have simply said, I haven't done those things because I am not president yet. It was a chance to offer a small civics class reminder. The vice president serves the president's agenda. She does not have the power to forge her own. I could also have been sharper with my answer to her question on fracking. It took me longer than it should have to clearly articulate the plain truth of my position. The climate crisis is an emergency. We urgently need to move off fossil fuels. But evidence had convinced me that we could do that without ending fracking. In 2020, I'd promised not to ban it. I hadn't banned it as vice president, and I would not ban it as president. I got there, but I could have gotten there quicker and cleaner. I fell off my game for most of the interview. Having Tim there beside me, in hindsight, was an error. Bash asked him few questions, and none offered a moment that revealed his charismatic personality or convictions. My campaign felt we should do the interview in tandem because it was a thing that had been done by prior candidates and their running mates. But because we'd waited to do this interview, there was so much riding on it. And the plan to have him there fed a narrative that I wasn't willing or able to go it alone. As we were beginning to wrap up, Bash asked me to comment on a photo from the convention that had gone viral. My baby niece Amara looking up at me as I stood behind the podium flanked by American flags, accepting the nomination. It's a wonderful image. The picture is taken from behind her. So what you see is her upturned head, bracketed by her two perky little braids. I hadn't belabored the historic nature of my candidacy as a black woman. I'd always felt that it was more important to stress that I was the most qualified person, regardless of race or gender. But that photo somehow spoke volumes about the past and the future. It reminded us how far we've come and that a woman and a person of color could be at that podium accepting that nomination. It also spoke volumes about how far we can go when children grow up knowing anything is possible for someone who looks just like them. It was the one answer where I would not change a word. August 30th, 67 days to the election. The signs went up overnight at the bus stops in Denver. Metal, official looking, professionally affixed to the bus stop poles. In all caps, "Blacks must sit at the back of the bus. Kamala's migrants sit in the front." Similar signs showed up 1,000 miles away in Chicago. Later in the campaign, a Nevada homeowner's yard sign supporting me was defaced with the N-word. The doorbell camera showed the vandal toting all the equipment he needed to do the job. When I became top of the ticket, Republican lawmakers had a closed-door meeting, the message of which was a warning to lay off overt attacks on race and gender and restrict criticism to my record in the Biden-Harris administration. This came after several members attacked me as a, quote, DEI hire. All of this did nothing to lower the volume of Trump's dog whistling. Sadly, racist, sexist attacks are not exclusive to Donald Trump, and someone had gone to a lot of trouble to make those bus signs. As the first woman or black woman in every office I have run for, except the Senate, where I was the second, racism and sexism have always been present. They were not new to me. I would not let them throw me off my game. September 4th, 62 days to the election. I'd planned to unveil my tax proposals to help small businesses at a picturesque brewery in Northampton, New Hampshire, and then to visit a family-owned pretzel-making factory nearby. I was keen to share my plan to boost new businesses with a $50,000 tax credit and to help existing ones expand with low and no interest loans. I was looking forward to the day, with perfect late summer weather predicted for our outdoor rally. Because I am passionate about small businesses, when I became vice president, the first meeting I scheduled outside of government departments was with small business owners. And right after that, with the CEOs of big banks to persuade them to do more small business lending. It's the biggest engine of employment in our economy, but it is even more than that. Small businesses are the glue that holds communities together. The cafe where the barista knows you, the local pharmacist who asks after your kid's earache or sore throat. When I was a child, before my mother saved enough for a down payment on our first home, we rented an apartment above Mrs. Shelton's nursery, and Mrs. Shelton looked after us while Mommy worked. She became a second mother to us, and she taught me early that the best business leaders are also civic leaders. Small businesses like Mrs. Shelton's represent the realization of millions of individual American dreams. But at 9:42 a.m., just as I was getting ready to head to the landing zone for Marine 2, a 14-year-old in Barrow County, Georgia, texted his father, "I'm sorry, it's not your fault." And then to his mother a second text, "I'm sorry." By 10:30 a.m., he had shot 11 people at Appalachie High School, where he was a freshman. He had killed Mason Skirmerhorn and Christian Angulo, both aged 14. A math teacher named Christina Irimi and a math teacher and assistant football coach, Richard Aspinwall. Aspinwall had stepped from his classroom to investigate the disturbance and was shot in the chest. His students pulled him back inside and tried to save his life, using their own shirts in a fruitless effort to staunch the bleeding. Unless you live in Georgia, you've probably forgotten about that shooting. Or maybe it's blurred into the details of the other 83 school shootings that happened in 2024. 83. And 2024 is not even our deadliest year. Appalachie High School had just about every recommended security measure. 3 armed officers on site, self-locking classroom doors, smart boards programmed to flash an active shooter alert in every classroom. Teachers whose high-tech ID badges included a panic button and real-time location software. It wasn't enough. You can buy a semi-automatic weapon in Georgia without a permit or any gun safety training. Just weeks before the shooting, state lawmakers tried to pass a law offering a $300 tax credit for installing a gun safe. Even that modest proposal failed to pass. We are the only country in the world where the leading cause of death for children is guns. Every day in America, there are parents who drop their kids off at the bus stop or at the school gate and say a silent prayer that their children will return home that day. As I set out for New Hampshire that morning, I'd only had a bare-bones briefing. I didn't yet have all the details on the shooting. I didn't yet know that the shooter's father had given his son a semi-automatic AR-15-style weapon as a Christmas gift, even though his boy had a picture of the Parkland school shooter on his bedroom wall and had been visited by police regarding threats he allegedly posted on Discord. What I did know, it doesn't have to be this way. As vice president, I drove the creation of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which led to the first major gun safety bill in nearly three decades. Looking at gun trafficking and the training of 14,000 new mental health workers to work in schools like Appalachia and help avert such tragedies. But we need to do so much more. As a gun owner myself, I am not coming to take away anybody's guns. I am with the majority of Americans who want an assault weapons ban. I am with those who want universal background checks and red flag laws. You just might want to know, before someone can buy a lethal weapon, if they've been convicted of a violent crime. You just might want to know if the person buying a gun is a danger to themselves or others. All of us certainly want to know our children can go to school, learn without fear, and come home safe. As a prosecutor, I studied autopsy photographs in the aftermath of shootings. I know exactly what semi-automatic rifle fire does to the human body, especially to the tiny body of a child. This may sound harsh, but somebody needs to get lawmakers in a locked room and make them look at those images. Then they can go out on the floor of the chamber and vote their conscience. In a statement that day, Donald Trump blamed the shooting on a, quote, sick and deranged monster. He did not mention the gun. Every country in the world has sick and deranged individuals. Only the United States had 83 school shootings in 2024. September 5th, 61 days to the election. It was time to hunker down for debate camp. We left for Pittsburgh in the early afternoon. I would be mostly off the campaign trail for 5 days. No small thing. Trump mocked me for it, but I knew how vital it was. We'd nailed the convention, and the debate was the next big test for my campaign. Most polls had us pulling ahead by more than 3 points. Since we had no firm commitment from Trump for another debate, I knew it might be my only chance to give voters a side-by-side comparison. I suspected that Trump was still riding the ego boost of trampling Joe and would have high confidence. Indeed, J.D. Vance bragged to CNN, quote, "We're not going to have some sort of formal debate prep session because Donald Trump doesn't need it," he said. I knew this was false and typical bluster. I was sure they would try to prepare him, and I was determined to put in the necessary work. The team had tricked out the ballroom of the historic Omni William Penn Hotel in Pittsburgh. It was done up to exactly reproduce the actual debate set, including the same lighting. It was freezing in there, as studio sets often are. The value of duplicating the exact set proved itself right away. We'd had made-to-measure podiums built, and when I placed my notebook on it, it slid right off. There would be no way to take notes on a podium with that steep of a slope. Brian Fallon called ABC and told them they needed to fix their design. Philippe Reines was my sparring partner. He was a longtime political operative who had served Hillary in her Senate and presidential campaigns and worked for her in the State Department. He'd had various roles, but was perhaps most well known as her take-no-prisoners, highly combative press spokesman. He called a reporter's question, quote, asinine, and told another to, quote, fuck off. He was able to harness this natural aggression when channeling Donald Trump. Reines had played Trump during Hillary's debate prep in 2016, and he approached the role with the dedication of a method actor. He had studied Trump's debates frame by frame, learning his every gesture. He memorized everything he'd said and exactly how he said it. Every night, he watched the video of Trump's latest rant to see if he'd updated any lines of attack. He wore makeup to give his skin an orange tinge, tortured his elegantly graying hair into a facsimile of Trump's cotton candy comb-over, and sported a long red tie dangling over his belt. He was also a total jerk, but solely in pursuit of honing my performance. He lied, was confrontational, tried to rattle me one moment, distract me the next. It was a high-level hazing. Not even during our breaks did he step out of character. The first day of debate camp, our method was to run through three or four questions, then stop, to review how I'd done, refining my answers. I had most of my team in Pittsburgh. Karen Dunn, Rohini Kosuglu, Mignon Moore, Cedric Richmond, David Plouffe, Sean Clegg, my longtime California political advisor and strategist, Ike Irby, Tony West, Brian Fallon, Lorraine Voles, and Sheila Nix, and later Jen O'Malley Dillon and Tony West. All there to tweak and tune my every phrase. Kirsten Allen and Colin Deersing role-played as ABC News moderators Lindsay Davis and David Muir. James Singer was there as fact-checker to go over every answer to make sure that on the night, I had the facts straight. Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, and my own national security advisor, Phil Gordon, also flew in to help shape my answers on foreign policy. Of all the president's responsibilities, foreign policy is among the weightiest. And yet, it is outside the experience of most Americans. The key is having advisors who understand the intersection of foreign and domestic policy and politics. Jake and Phil are gifted and helped me find words that would be immediately accessible to everyone, including those whose busy lives have little time to learn acronyms like AUKUS or JCPOA, but who want to know how these key agreements work to make our country more secure. What had kept me up, long before I was the top of the ticket, was the sadness of realizing that many Americans don't fully understand how important they are to the rest of the world. Not the American government, the American people. We the people have for so long embodied ideals of equality, generosity, enterprise. In the eyes of many, we have been the reliable allies, the trusted friends, a source of aspiration and inspiration. I knew Trump couldn't care less about the moral leadership of America and the rest of the world. His perverse notion of what strength looks like is, I believe, out of step with most Americans. I think the true strength of a leader is based not on who you beat down, but who you lift up. His is a stunted, narrow definition of strength, the strength of a bully. I hoped the debate would offer a moment to starkly reveal our difference. I wanted to show that he was very weak and entirely vulnerable, more interested in favor, grift, and flattery, and would yield to that, manipulated by leaders like Putin. September 6th, 60 days to the election. By the second day, I was working without my note cards, and we were going the full 90 minutes, then doing it again and again. It matters that you get your reps in. You must get used to the cadence. You must get used to the clock. As for an athlete, a great shooter can't score if the shot comes after the buzzer. Say the subject is the color green. You might have a bunch of incredible things to say on the subject of green, but the buzzer goes before you've landed your best point, and by the time you get to speak again, the subject's changed to orange. If you try to make your final great point about green, you won't have time left to spell out your position on orange. Complex answers are often punished by the unforgiving clock. After we ran through a full mock debate, I would leave the ballroom while the team deconstructed and analyzed my every answer. Because there were so many advisors, they didn't want 10 or a dozen different voices bombarding me. While I was out of the room, they'd synthesize everyone's opinions. She was visibly annoyed by that question. We've got to get her immune to that. She needs to get to that answer faster. She forgot to make that point. Storm would make me a cup of tea. The team, if they were being kind, would bring me a small bag of Doritos, which felt like being handed a doggy treat. I'd come back in, and Karen or Rohini would deliver the critique. Then we'd do it all over again, going late into the evening so that I practiced how it felt to do the debate at the actual time it would take place. I was on my feet the whole time. It's a test of endurance as much as anything. Keeping the energy, staying focused. Questions I'd prepared for, new ones I hadn't. And always, under the glare of the lights, the digital clock flashing. September 7th, 59 days to the election. I wanted to get out of the hotel and out of my head for an hour. So we scheduled a lunchtime visit to a small business. Penzi's Spices is a Wisconsin-based company that has stores in more than 20 states. Bill Penzi, the founder of the 30-year-old business, has long been an outspoken anti-racist and a critic of Donald Trump's politics of division. The company had a store not far from the hotel, so we headed over there. Even though the visit hadn't been on my official schedule, none of these drop-ins could be for security reasons. A big, enthusiastic crowd gathered in the narrow street as soon as the motorcade pulled up. They started chanting, "We're not going back." My mother bought her spices in bulk and stored them in used Taster's Choice coffee jars. I felt right at home in the store's delicious aromas of cardamom, clove, and nutmeg. I chatted with the families browsing the store. One woman wept, saying she was afraid for the country if Trump was reelected. "We're going to be fine," I reassured her. "We're all in this together." Before I left, I loaded up on some of my favorite Penzi's mixes: Fox Point, Creamy Peppercorn, and Trinidad Lemon Garlic Marinade, for Cole and his wife Greenlee. The rest for me. One day, I thought, I'll get a chance to use them. A couple of the pool reporters had followed me into the store. One asked, "Best part of debate prep for you?" "Being at this spice store," I replied. They had no idea how much I meant it. September 8th, 58 days to the election. I hate my debate team. I was on the phone venting to my bestie, Chrisette. Of course, I did not hate my debate team. I loved them, but they were killing me. By Sunday afternoon, I was fried. I needed to get away from that podium, from the stage lights, from my bullying nemesis in the droopy red tie. I needed some time alone with Doug, who'd arrived the day before. I needed fresh air. I needed a walk. In my position, a spur-of-the-moment Sunday afternoon stroll is no small undertaking. We conferred with my Secret Service detail. The only secure place possible at short notice, they said, was a National Guard airbase about half an hour away. Imagine the scene in The Godfather when Michael Corleone is on a stroll in the Sicilian hills with his fiancée Apollonia. It is such an intimate moment. Then, as the couple walks on together, just about the entire village strolls into the frame, following behind them. Well, that's how our walk felt. The airbase was far from a scenic Sicilian hillside. Doug, me, a row of C-17 warplanes, and our many chaperones. The motorcade pulled in behind a building. My assistant Opal described our path. She pointed out that as soon as we turned the corner, we'd be in view of the press pool for the rest of the walk. And of course, my Secret Service detail would be right there with us. It's impossible to get a moment when I don't have to be self-aware. If I leave the privacy of my room, someone is always observing me. Doug and I navigated the perimeter of that treeless tarmac, laughing about how surreal our lives had become. It was a mild, sunny afternoon. Like Michael and Apollonia, we made the most of our moment together. September 9th, 57 days to the election. Was I the only one seeing the fly? In the middle of the 2020 vice presidential debate, it landed on Mike Pence's head during his answer to a question on race in America. And there it sat, a dark presence on his snow-white hair. Should I motion to him to brush it away? If I did, he or the audience might misinterpret the gesture. I thought about how to say something, but I didn't want to embarrass him or throw him off or seem to be trivializing the debate. All of these thoughts when I needed to be focused on what he was saying. You can prepare forever, but you can't know what will happen in a debate, live in front of tens of millions of people. In the late afternoon, we decamped from Pittsburgh and headed for Philly. September 10th, 56 days to the election. Debate day. That morning, I went for a walkthrough of the actual set the studio had created for the debate. It's important to know every detail, what will be in your line of sight, whether the cameras will be on you when you're not speaking, even the length of the walk to the podium. The room was so much smaller than where we practiced. Network aides showed me where the moderators would sit, where the digital clock would be. Then we headed back to the hotel for what I thought would be a practice of my closing statement, a final tune-up before the real thing. Philippe Reines surprised me by entering the room dressed as himself, not Donald Trump. Unbeknownst to me, he and Karen Dunn had decided that the last thing I needed at that point was more intense work. They'd cooked up something different. Philippe rose to give what I thought would be a mock Trump closing statement. Instead, it was a comic monologue. He started by making fun of me for what he called my unpolitician-like punctuality. What politician do you know who is ever on time? Sometimes she even gets there first, he said. Then he hunched his tall frame and pitched his naturally deep voice into a high register. I may look big and strong, but I'm really a very small, very scared little man. And finally, dropping the Trump character entirely, he turned and looked at me directly for the first time in 5 days of prep sessions. He spoke about my strengths and ended with a twist on the, quote, radical label that his mock Trump had been hurling at me. You're radically ready. You've got this. It was exactly what I needed to hear in that moment, and I was so grateful. It was followed by something that I didn't need to hear at all. I was in my room at the hotel in Philadelphia, wrapped in a robe, fat rollers in my hair. The makeup artist had left. It was just Doug and me and my pre-debate butterflies. I got a call that Joe Biden wanted to talk to me. I was pleased that the president had thought to give me a pre-debate pep talk. "I'm calling to wish you good luck," Joe said. But there was little warmth in his voice. Still, he thought to call. "I love you," I replied, smiling. "I'm about to go into the boxing ring." "You're going to do fine," he said. Then, with barely a pause, "By the way, are you going to be back in Philadelphia between now and the election?" Why is he asking that, I wondered. It seemed, under the circumstances, a non sequitur. I told him I wasn't sure. I'd certainly be back in Pennsylvania, but I'd have to check my schedule to see which locations. "My brother called. He said he's been talking to a group of real power brokers in Philly." He rattled off several names. "Do you know them?" "No," I replied, thinking he was maybe going to offer to introduce me to them or call them on my behalf. But I was confused as to why he was raising this right now, on this day. Then he got to his point. His brother had told him that those guys were not going to support me because I'd been saying bad things about him. He wasn't inclined to believe it, he claimed, but he thought I should know in case my team had been encouraging me to put daylight between the two of us. "Okay, we'll have those guys talk to me directly," I said. "I'd like to meet them." Joe then rattled on about his own former debate performances. "I beat him the other time. I wasn't feeling well in that last one," he said. He continued to insist that his debate performance hadn't hurt him with the electorate. I was barely listening. He knew what it was like to be in my seat, getting ready to face Trump one-on-one. Indeed, he and Hillary Rodham Clinton were the only humans who knew what it was like. The pressure I was under before I would step onto that stage was immense. I just likened it to a fighter going into a boxing ring for the big prize fight, and that's what it felt like. Only worse, because the outcome of my performance wasn't just a win or loss for me. It had grave consequences for the country, even for the world. My head had to be right. I had to be completely in the game. I just couldn't understand why he would call me right now and make it all about himself, distracting me with worry about hostile power brokers in the biggest city of the most important swing state. Doug could see how angry and disappointed I was. "Let it go," he said. He knew I had to redirect my focus. "Don't worry about him. You're dealing with Trump. Let it go." 67 million people witnessed what happened next. Donald Trump and I had never met. So when he walked right to his podium, I strode past mine over to him, extended my hand, and introduced myself. It wasn't a tactic. I always shake hands when I meet someone for the first time. I told my prep team I would do it because it was the natural and polite thing to do. Trump's eyes widened. He hadn't expected this. He took my outstretched hand almost deferentially. "Kamala Harris," I said. "Let's have a good debate." In rehearsals, someone suggested saying it's pronounced Kamala. But at the last minute, I decided not to. It felt bitchy. It was the last time he looked at me in the entire 90 minutes. The small set was bathed in blue lights with a graphic of the Constitution behind the two podiums. It was lit so that from my podium, I couldn't see anything except the impassive faces of the moderators and a massive screen featuring a countdown clock, which I glanced at every now and then to make sure I had time to land my points. Donald Trump had won the toss and opted to give the first opening statement. He launched right into his lies about immigrants being rapists and murderers, stealing quote-unquote black jobs. I figured viewers would understand how demeaning and ludicrous that was, since I was right there on stage, enjoying my black job as vice president. He bragged about his economic plan, his tariffs, which gave me a golden opportunity to punch right back. I was coursing with adrenaline. I'd studied this stuff for my entire career. I knew what those tariffs would do to the American people. Trump's tariffs, I said, were nothing but a national sales tax that would send prices soaring and would plunge us into a recession by the following summer. I quoted 16 Nobel laureate economists to back me up. He responded with the absurd claim that I was a Marxist and disparaged my father. I decided not to go on his turf and hoped my smile and raised eyebrow indicated how ridiculous it was. He has a skill for going for the very personal and pulling people into a false sense of reality, forcing them to debate nonsense. Running after his crazy lies was a trap I was determined to avoid. When the question turned to abortion, Trump branded our policy as, quote, extreme, and then repeated his lie about Democratic states allowing newborns to be put to death. There hadn't been any real-time fact-checking in Joe Biden's debate, but this time, to their credit, the moderators cut in to say that there was no state in which such a practice was allowed. No matter what question the moderators asked, Trump tried to turn it back to his scaremongering of an immigrant, quote, invasion. I pointed out that he'd killed the bipartisan bill that would have strengthened the border because he would rather run on a problem than fix a problem. And I said that his rantings had become so rambling and tedious that people leave his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom. His obsession with his crowd sizes led him to take this bait. He had no good explanation as to why he had killed the bill, so he embarked on his, quote, eating the pets rant. I could not believe he was saying it. The cameras caught my look of incredulity. I did have some clue that it might have been on his mind. Kirsten and Brian had noticed that when Trump deplaned in Philly, Laura Loomer, the conspiracy theorist who had been identified as a proponent of his garbage, was traveling with him. Apparently, as the last thing he heard, it stuck in his head. It served to make my point about how unhinged he had become. Once again, the moderators stepped in to say that his claim that Haitians had stolen and killed pets for food had been debunked by none other than the Springfield, Ohio city manager. Talk about extreme, I interjected. It's his familiar tactic. Say the crazy. Everyone will dive on it. That will be the headline, the distraction. They will follow the heat instead of, for instance, his policy on tariffs. When Trump tried to claim that crime was rising under our administration when it was actually falling, I answered that it was rich for someone who had been prosecuted and convicted of numerous felonies to be positioning himself as a champion of law and order. I heard him audibly gasp when I mentioned his convictions. He shot back that I had been in favor of defunding the police. Another lie. Even though my mic was off, I said, "That's not true." He heard me and snapped, "I'm talking now." "Don't lie," I countered. The camera was on me then, and you didn't need to be a lip reader to understand what I'd said. We were not allowed to interact with anyone during the commercial breaks. Trump walked off the stage in one direction, I went the other. I took a moment in the wings and then went back to the podium, alone in my head, watching the seconds flash by on the massive clock until I could re-engage. There was little he said that night that I hadn't gamed out, but there were spontaneous moments where my adrenaline-flooded synapses fired off retorts I came up with on the spot. When Trump tried to justify his bogus claim that the 2020 election had been stolen, I pointed out that this was a man who had been fired by 81 million Americans and, quote, clearly He is having a very difficult time processing that. Another moment came as he attacked us on a vulnerability, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. It was important that people understood the origins of that tragedy. It began with the disastrous deal he'd struck with the Taliban, committing us to an impossibly rapid exit date. It infuriated me. He had invited the Taliban, murderous terrorists, torturers, heinous oppressors of women, to Camp David, where true statesmen had worked to create real peace. I gestured toward him to reinforce the contrast. And this, I could feel the retort forming itself on my lips. I confess that sometimes I have a salty mouth. I keep it in check on most occasions. But the adrenaline was taking over. In a long pause, I just managed to stifle the name I so badly wanted to call him. And this former president, as president, invited them to Camp David. Even though I hadn't actually said it, plenty of people filled in the blank. Later, the comedian Wanda Sykes would remark that I'd called the former president a, quote, motherfucker to his face without using the word. When the debate ended, I genuinely had no idea how I'd done. I felt like a survivor in the aftermath of a bomb blast, barely able to hear what was being said to me, for the whooshing in my ears. I could see Doug's face swimming in front of me as he came up on the stage. He was talking, but I couldn't take in what he said. I registered the fact that he was smiling. Well then, I thought, I must have done okay. September 11th, 55 days to the election. I'd had about 2 hours sleep when the alarm on my phone went off in my New York hotel room. The night before, Doug and I had gone from the debate stage to the holding room where the entire team was assembled. I grabbed Philippe and kissed him with gratitude. Over the heads in the group, I saw Lorraine crying. The tough taskmaster of my staff and daily agenda, she never cries. "You really do care about more than just my schedule," I teased. Brian, usually dead serious, was grinning ear to ear. "I checked off all the numbers on my bingo card," he said. "You made every point." Later, Opal started playing Taylor Swift songs on her phone. Swift had just posted her thoughtful endorsement. Quote, "I believe we can accomplish so much more in this country if we are led by calm and not chaos," she wrote, signing off her post, "Childless Cat Lady." The Harris Walls campaign watch party at the Cherry Street Pier was thronged with celebrating supporters. I knew very well that this election would not be decided by a single event, a single debate victory. When I took the mic, I told everyone that it had been a good night, but tomorrow was back to work. Then I left for New York. By the time I collapsed on the bed in my hotel room, it was close to 2 a.m. I was up just a couple of hours later to prepare for a somber day of 3 memorials: New York, Shanksville, the Pentagon. At 7:50 a.m., I was back in the motorcade rolling to Ground Zero for the ceremony honoring the victims of 9/11. I'd been there as vice president every year except during COVID. Hundreds of people in black stood in silence, the memorial's waterfalls the only audible sound in the heart of that busy city. I stood next to the president. Michael Bloomberg was on his left, Donald Trump on the other side of the mayor. Trump and I shook hands. He said, "You were great last night." I didn't know what to say in return except, "You too." It was a warm, clear, beautiful morning, just as it had been in 2001. The NYPD honor guard began a solemn drumbeat. At 8:46 a.m., the moment the first plane hit the North Tower, the drumbeat ceased. We all fell silent in memory of the dead. 23 years earlier, I was a young city attorney in San Francisco, getting an early start on the treadmill at my gym before heading to the office. There were three giant TVs in the gym, and as they played the moment when the first plane hit the tower, I turned off the treadmill and stepped down to follow the coverage. I remember the music in the gym stopped. Everyone stood side by side, watching in disbelief. The reading of the names is a melancholy and moving tradition. The president and I departed as quietly and reverently as we could, about an hour into that litany of loss. We needed to leave for Shanksville, Pennsylvania, to commemorate the heroes of Flight 93. The route from Johnstown Cambria County Airport to the Shanksville Memorial Site runs through cornfields, wooded hills, and forests of Trump signs. Trump 2024, Vote Republican, America Must End Abortion. It was a small crowd at Shanksville. About 200 had gathered, many of them family or friends of those who perished on the flight. The president and I laid a wreath at the memorial and then walked out to the crash site. I was taken aback that on that day and in this place, I would see a man in the crowd wearing a bright red shirt, emblazoned with messages, insulting me in the most vulgar terms. "Commie Kamala sucks," and "abort Harris" were the printable parts, interspersed with lewd sexual references. This was such a solemn memorial service. It made me immensely sad.